4.7.
So some of this may be overlap with that. Some of it may actually overlap a bit with some things that were done in Grant 216. Sometimes, I don't know how often they do these things in Grant 216. So we'll, you can tell me. How's that? So mostly we're going to be talking here about now what's called network security, which is concerned with the security of messages. Security issues associated with things flowing over the network. In some sense, computer security might be called the security of data at rest, and this the security of data in motion, but a lot of overlap, I suspect, between those two things. So we will be talking somewhat about kinds of cryptography, which I think is sort of interesting in its own right, but to me the key, that's not a pun, it's a mistake, the key issue is authentication, often, and the authentication of parties and entities that are party to conversations. So we'll talk about that. And then we'll talk about some network security and practice things, firewalls, intrusion detection, and how we achieve security at different layers. One of the things that is extremely apparent in the world today is that although you can have sort of great cryptography in principle, you can have great cryptography specifications, a lot of what goes wrong is associated with implementations that don't behave as expected. So getting to having layers of protection, rings of protection, is all pretty important. Okay, so basics followed by cryptography principles. That's what we're doing. So, basic terminology, confidentiality, is the idea that only the sender and the intended receiver should understand message contents. And it's achieved typically by encryption and decryption at the other end. Authentication is that the sender and receiver want to know each other's identities. And this actually comes in two forms. One is the form of how do you know that the person at the other end is who you think it is in the first place? And second of all, how do you understand that messages that you think are coming from that person who you know it is are actually coming from that person, right? So there's two aspects of that that often get, in my experience, sort of blurred together. And I'll try to provide some separation on that as we go through this. Message integrity is just making sure that messages are not altered in transit. And access and availability is that it's sort of the opposite of denial of service, right? That systems are not useful if they're not available and provide access. So you often hear about the CIA properties. Those are confidentiality, integrity, which includes authentication in that formulation, and availability. So CIA is confidentiality, integrity, and availability, and everybody must have thought that was a very clever thing to have thought of 30 years ago, but I don't know, it doesn't seem all that wonderful these days. So, here's the classic problem. For network security, you have a communication channel. There is messages flowing across the channel. The messages consist of data and other parts of the protocol, just like any other protocol, typically. and they want to communicate securely. So we'll define what securely means as we go along. But there's this assumption that there's this intruder, Trudy, who can typically intercept, delete, add messages to the channel with the goal of confusing Alice and Bob about something, whether it's the integrity of a message, whether it's the, or to attempt to read their messages. What was I going to say about this? Oh, yes. A whole part of the security picture that is not addressed in this chapter and largely not addressed in security classes, but nevertheless important in the real world, is it doesn't say anything at all about the behavior of Bob and Alice. In some sense, there's an assumption in this whole model that Bob and Alice trust each other. Okay? And that may or may not be true in a lot of situations. What does it mean to trust someone? It's basically to believe that they're going to operate according to your model of how they should operate. And that may or may not be true. And the question is, for research, how do Alice and Bob sort of come to trust decisions about one another? You know, they know that they're not supposed to trust Trudy. She's a bad guy. But what about each other? What about the parties that you are actually dealing with? When you go online and deal with a merchant online, do you trust that merchant? Well, sometimes I do, and sometimes I don't. And whether I do or don't affects the way that I may choose to pay them. Pay them through PayPal, which doesn't disclose any credit card numbers, or pay them with a credit card, which does, or pay them with a one-time credit card. You have some limitations there that you can impose, but it has to do with trust. Okay, so real life, Bob and Alice, web browser and server. Notice, let's think about this. We'll just looking ahead. Suppose that you're interacting with a web server, an HTTPS web server. What are the security properties of a connection like that? What do you expect it to be providing?
A certificate.
What's that?
Is it like a certificate?
Well, that's how it's implemented. But what are we trying to achieve with such a connection? Trust. Trust, like what kind of trust? What do we want to know for an HTTPS connection?
Who you're talking to.
We want to know who we're talking to, right? So that's an authentication issue. Who is it that we're talking to? Also, those HTTPS connections provide encryption of the messages that are sent from your browser to the other end, and vice versa. Okay, so that helps keep other people from seeing those communications that you're having, but really, it all keys off of having knowledge of who it is at the other end. Now, what about from the perspective of the person at the other end? Say it's your bank. What's their interest in this connection? What do they want security-wise? Certainly the confidentiality. What does it provide them about your identity? Nothing. Okay? HTTPS doesn't build in the way it's most used, anything about the identity of the client side. Instead, you go through some process where you enter a username and password, maybe a something else, and somehow the bank comes to understand your identity through that process. So now let's turn it around one more time and say, what is your interest in the bank having your identity correct? Right, exactly. The bank is in some sense protecting your interest by insisting that you be authenticated to them. Right? And so you have a vital interest as well in the bank's ability to authenticate you or not. And I would claim that we don't necessarily do, overall we don't necessarily do a terribly good job of that, but we seem to do a good enough job to keep the wheels turning so far. Okay. Other issues. DNS. So remember DNS? DNS is the thing that translates names like www.wsu.edu into IP addresses. Do you believe the answer that you get from the DNS server? Typically, yes. Right? Typically, yes. Suppose that the bank, suppose that the DNS server gives you the wrong IP address for something that you're trying to connect to. If it's HTTPS, you're now sort of critically reliant on the certificate mechanism to ensure that you're really talking to the right person. The security mechanisms have broken down. People have been issued certificates for names that are not theirs. DNS servers have been compromised to give wrong answers, allowing people to conduct what are called man-in-the-middle attacks. You know, if you looked at the worst case of all of this, you'd never do anything at all. You just look at the things that have already happened, you would say, no. But we don't, do we? We say, well, I think it's going to be okay this time. Sometimes we're wrong. Sometimes we're not. Mostly we're not wrong. So what do we assume bad guys can do? They can intercept messages, that's called eavesdropping. They can insert messages, again, attempting to confuse people who are involved in the protocols. It's very easy in IP networks to insert whatever source address you want into a packet. Right? Just stuff it in there, send it off. It will go on its way to its destination, and nobody will check, mostly. Now, if you do that, if you insert a fake source address in an IP packet, when it gets to the other end, they're actually not going to be replying to you, are they? They're going to be replying to the other person. That can form the basis of denial of service attacks by getting lots of people to reply to your victim. You can do that. You can attempt to take over an ongoing connection. So you have a TCP connection. Can somebody sort of who is able to listen to that TCP connection actually get in the middle of it and cause and be able to see the traffic in it? It's harder if it's encrypted, certainly. And finally, denial of service. And then, of course, there's the whole thing about misbehavior of the principal parties, Alice and Bob, which who can also be bad guys. So let's talk about cryptography. I don't know if this is visible. It says encryption algorithm in this box and decryption algorithm here. The terminology is that we start with a plain text message. We encrypt it with Alice's key. We send the encrypted message called the ciphertext over the data channel. Remember, that's what this is. it's delivered here where Bob runs his decryption algorithm using his decryption key. So the general story is encryption with one key and decryption with a different key, or at least a different algorithm. But we, well, save that. Okay, so how does it get broken? Terminology for breaking encryption systems. There are what are called ciphertext-only attacks. That means that the bad guy has the message from here and is attempting to figure out what it says. Okay? And there are different approaches to doing that. There's the one that we wish was the case always, which is that the intruder has to cycle through all the possible keys with the expected time to break the key of, you know, half the number of, to break the message of half the number of available keys. So just by using big, you'd think just by using big keys, all would be well, right? That's true, as long as you have a crypto system that is only susceptible to brute force attacks. At the level of crypto systems, the danger is that it's maybe possible to do statistical analysis on many messages and get hints about the keys without having to search through all of them. So, for example, the famous Enigma ciphers of World War II were broken on the basis of ciphertext that was known, and occasional bits of that ciphertext, pieces of that ciphertext that were also predictable. So, at the beginning of the message, there might be something that said Wednesday. Okay, and all the messages for Wednesday might say Wednesday at the beginning of them. The messages would all look different, but knowing that they all started out saying Wednesday in a particular position might give you some clue as to what the key in use was for Wednesday. Okay, and indeed, this is what this is how it went. To the point that eventually the people at Bletchley Park were able to sort of, based on a somewhat brute force search, but not a complete brute force search, figure out keys almost daily for the Enigma machines used by the Germans. So that's the danger with you want it to be brute force, but statistical analysis will get you faster. So again, the Enigma cipher had a certain known plain text characteristic to it, but only for pieces of the message. And finally, there's the possibility, and these are exploited as well, that the intruder may be able to convince the one of Alice or Bob to encipher messages that the intruder chooses. Okay. And again, this gives you a handle into the statistical analysis of the system. But as I say, both of these are often sort of far below the bad effects created by bad implementations of systems. Oh, and bad implementations can increase the possibility of statistical analysis. Okay, so we're going to talk now about what are called symmetric key cryptosystems and public key cryptosystems, starting with symmetric key. Symmetric key says the encryption and decryption takes place with the same key.
Okay.
And a different, and potentially a different algorithm. So, you run it through the algorithm using Alice's key, and you decrypt it using the same key. I would have preferred that they used KS to the minus one there to say that that was actually the inverse key, or at least the inverse algorithm. I don't know. These two algorithms are at least potentially different. So, the big question with this is, how do Bob and Alice agree on a key value and do so in a way that they know that each other are the only ones who have the key? That's the big issue here. So, typically, we'll see this later when we talk about things, but typically, there is some sort of assistance provided in the overall crypto system for this key distribution problem of how do Alice and Bob find out about the keys that they're supposed to share. It's possible for Alice, there's an algorithm called the Diffie-Hellman key exchange algorithm that allows Alice and Bob to create such a key on the fly. There's a certain set of interactions that they can have that will allow them to create a key with nobody else knowing it. The problem with that algorithm is that it doesn't ensure Alice that she's really talking to Bob, or Bob that she's really talking to, that he's really talking to Alice. In other words, you end up with a key that's good for having a secret conversation with somebody, but you don't really know who the somebody is. Which probably isn't what you're after.
And the only way to check that they are who they say they are is to use some kind of encryption, which requires a key.
Right, exactly. So there need to be some other mechanisms in the system for authentication, and that's where third parties come in. So Alice can give the key to a trusted courier to carry to Bob, and the courier must be trusted by Alice and Bob to not look at the key, either because it's locked up or something, and to only deliver it to Bob. So now I get to have a rant about trust. Okay. So what does it mean to say that the courier is trusted? Is that a property of the courier? Or is that a property of Alice and Bob? If I say the courier is trusted, does that tell you anything about the courier's behavior?
Kind of. I mean, if 100 people have gone to this person and said, I need to have a secret conversation with my friend, and those 100 people, there doesn't appear to be any kind of malicious attack or hacking or anything like that,
right,
then maybe their 101st time will also ensure a secret conversation.
Okay, so you can gather evidence that the courier is trustworthy, right? How has it behaved before? But to merely say it is trusted is really, I claim, a statement about Alice's and Bob's beliefs about the courier, okay? And their behavior with respect to the courier. Say, I'm going to give, when I say that courier is trusted, I'm putting something into his hands, and I'm trusting him, right? And what does that mean? That means that if he doesn't behave according to my expectations of him, I'm screwed. Right? So whenever somebody tells you that that's a trusted entity, to me, that says alarm bells go off, because it's saying that in this protocol or whatever, if that guy doesn't behave according to his specification, things are broken. So this is, you know, there was a few years ago, there was this big push to include something called the Trusted Platform Module in all computers. It was a device that could do cryptography, it could store secret keys, all kinds of things. But what was never clear in that discussion was who was it who was supposed to trust that Trusted Platform Module. And why were they supposed to trust it? What was the basis for that trust? It was not clear. And so people sort of intuitively got that that was a problem. And a lot of people sort of insisted then that it be possible to not enable that on their computers, to not use it, because it was not clear who it was that was supposed to be trusting that. And in fact, you know, subsequent events have suggested that maybe that was a good good choice on the part of people. Well, you know, I don't think we need to go through simple substitution ciphers. I mean, haven't we all been doing this as nerds since the time we were in second grade? Really? Think? I know those of you who are at 355 did one as part of one of the projects at 355. But it's not a very good cycle. Right? You just simply choose one letter corresponding to it. You can make it more complicated. You can use different substitution ciphers for different letters and cycle through them. You can use a keyword to choose amongst them. Now just, they're all not very good ciphers. Nobody uses this. Was recognized way back, and in the early 90s, the NIST is a very important acronym in this field, National Institutes of Standards and Technology. They're responsible for managing the standards in the cryptographic field as used by the federal government. They don't necessarily create the cryptographic standards, the cryptographic techniques, but they work to standardize them, to test them, and so forth. So DES used a 56-bit symmetric key to encrypt blocks of 64-bit plaintext. Turns out that sometime around 2000, I think, somebody was able to decrypt this in a brute force way in less than a day. The good news is that there's no good analytic attack. So it really is brute force, as far as anybody knows. Of course, the NSA might make no difference, but we don't know. So because this was broken and there wasn't anything to anything to replace it, something called 3DES sort of got created as a stopgap measure, which lets you use three times bigger keys, and go three times slower. So DES is a combination of a substitution cipher and a mixing cipher. Basically, a mixing cipher is one that takes the bits of the original input and sort of scrambles them, just rearranges them. And the DES does that through multiple rounds, followed by substitutions. Oh yes, these things do substitutions,
and these things do mixing. And so that's the approach that is used in DES. It's also what's used in what's called AES, the Advanced Encryption Standard, that came out in 2001, allows up to 256-bit keys, and you know, people think that it is only breakable by brute force, and brute force is essentially impossible, although this particular statement about taking 1 second to do a DES encryption is a DES try is just completely bogus at this point. You can do a single DES trial decryption in probably at most a millisecond, and probably 100 microseconds on sort of modern hardware. So this symmetric key stuff is really fast, but really fast also translates into easier to attack with brute force because you can try out so many things. So, you know, I'd say, so if they say 1 second and I say a millisecond, lop a thousand, so it's only 149 billion years, but okay. Yeah.
So this is saying that you can decrypt DES in 1 second, like brute force it?
No, this was claiming that you could try a key in 1 second.
Oh. Each key would take an entire second?
And that's what I'm saying. Each key will take more like a millisecond or 100 microseconds.
Sure. But you could still crack DES in a matter of hours then?
You could crack DES by brute force in a matter of hours. This was what happened if you sort of expanded the key size. Okay, so as far as anybody knows, outside the NSA, AES is secure against brute force attacks just because of how long they would take. There may be other things that, you know, there may be statistical approaches, but we don't know what those are. Okay, so public key cryptography is something that was invented in the late 1970s, and it takes a radically different approach to the way cryptography works compared to symmetric key. From a practical point of view, the oh, gee, I didn't know it said radically different approach. Okay. Didn't remember that when I said. The sender and the receiver do not have a shared key. In fact, one of the keys can be public without compromising the security of the system. And we'll see how that works. We still have the issue about authentication. We'll talk about that. That actually is something that makes this less attractive than it might otherwise be. This is okay. So this is not really what's radically different yet. I'll show you what's radically different here in a second. So the idea here is that Alice encrypts with the public key belonging to Bob, and Bob, with his private key, does decryption. Okay? So what does that mean? That means that anybody who wants to send to Bob can use the same key. And the secrecy of the message depends on the fact that they can only be decrypted with the private key, which presumably only Bob knows. But this is not really what's so radically different. What's radically different is that, we treat messages as numbers.
Now, note, think about DES. Think about the substitution cipher. Think about the mixing ciphers. Up to this point, we've only thought about messages as being made up of these sort of discrete things, the bits of the message, or maybe a few bits of the message. We rearrange the bits. We substitute some bits for other bits. Okay. What the guys who invented public key cryptography did, and where I see it being radically different, is that they said a bit string is a number. Okay? And because it's a number, we can apply functions that compute on numbers to messages.
A mathematical system.
We have a, well, the others are mathematical as well in a way. But this is a numerical system. Okay? The others are kind of logical. This is numerical. Messages are numbers. Keys are numbers. And the things that we do to messages are things like multiplying them, exponentiating them, and so forth. So what that did for them was it opened up a whole new class of potential algorithms for doing encryption and decryption that people hadn't ever thought of before. And since their goal was to produce these pairs of keys such that it was hard to go from the public key to the private key, that was a good thing, because that such things sort of are not clear how they would work in the mixing it up and substituting world, but they were able to figure out several useful candidates in this world of treating things as numbers. Turns out that most of them ended up not working so well, but this one called RSA, after the initials of its creator, has pretty well stood the test of time. And then later on, there's something called elliptic curve cryptography that uses some of the similar ideas, but different in detail, to achieve some of the same results. So, given that we're going to treat things as numbers, the key mathematical idea here on which almost everything is based is this idea of operation modulo n. And I saw this when I was in fifth grade, I suppose. Did you see this in fifth grade? You see this in Math 216? Maybe. Okay. So, what is operation modulo n? It's you do the operation and you take the remainder when that's divided by n. Okay? And what you end up with is, therefore, essentially a finite system of numbers, right? Numbers only from 0 to n minus 1 are all that you can represent. But it has these nice properties that if you take two things that are themselves represent modulo n and take a modulo n, it's the same thing as just doing one modulo n operation. Exponentiation does the same thing. So it's all pretty slick. But it's a different way of thinking about numbers, right? If you're always thinking about what's the remainder when the number is divided by n. Oh, another use of this, another place where you're used to this, right, is in converting numbers between one base and another, or finding the representation of a number in a given base, right? What do? You divide the number by the base, take the remainder, that's the low order digit, divide the quotient by the base, get the next digit, and so on and so forth. Okay. So that's and you're used to the mod function in different programming languages to do this, but you have to think about the properties of this
overall system a bit beyond just what does the modulo operation do. Okay. So we'll go through RSA. It's in the book. And I'll give you an assignment that involves doing some of these computations just to see it. But we won't do the number theory proofs that are behind this. But we'll see some of the steps in the way. So the idea, the thing that makes RSA work as a public key crypto system, is that it is computationally difficult, as far as anyone knows, and this is in a sort of different sense than the NSA remarks earlier. Sort of, as far as anyone knows, it is very difficult computationally, given a large number that is the product of two prime numbers, to find those two prime numbers. And that's what the security of RSA relies on. If it were easy to figure out P and Q from given N, then it would be very easy to break RSA. Okay? So this is one of the things that people worry about with RSA, is sort of, is there a number theoretic mathematical result on the horizon that would sort of break everything. That's one thing. Okay, so that's the mathematical version of the issue. But there's another issue that has recently come to light, and it's an implementation issue with this. Suppose that I pick N equal to P times Q1, and you pick N2 equal to P times Q2. Okay? And suppose Trudy gets her hands on N1 and N2. Now, individually, it's very difficult to factor N1 to factor N2. But do you remember GCD? That famous algorithm from what, Computer Science 121 or something? The greatest common divisor algorithm is a fast algorithm, even on these very large numbers. If I have two of these N's that have a common factor, it's possible to find that common factor. And once I find that common factor, then it's very easy to find the two Q's. Okay? So the problem sort of in the implementation of RSA is that although it's hard to factor an N in the abstract, if different people have computed different N's and published them, they're part of the public keys, and you go around and you compare public keys with each other, trying to do GCDs on them, and you ever get a hit, then you've broken both of the private keys. So some people did this research about a year and a half ago. They went out and they collected it, because these are public numbers, right? These are part of the public key. They went out and collected the N's from a bunch of certificates from major websites, and they did this operation of doing GCD on all of the pairs, and lo and behold, they found collisions. Okay? Well, you're supposed to choose your P and Q randomly. So that suggests that there's actually a bad random number generator out in the world somewhere that is not doing so well at picking P's and Q's. But I think it's very interesting that although the system in theory depends on the difficulty of factoring, in the actual implementation, it can end up relying only on the difficulty of GCD, which is not hard at all. So once again, implementation versus theory is. So I have to tell you my.
So what did they compare? They compared the ends of the public keys, but what did they compare that to? Other ends?
Other ends.
Oh.
They just pick the ends out of that those two certificates and do a GCD operation. If you get something that's not one, you found a factor for both of them. And then it's easy to find the other factor. Yeah. Okay, so going on. So we pick these two big random numbers, prime numbers. The other question is, how do you know that numbers are prime? Well, it turns out that figuring out whether a number is prime or not is much easier than factoring, at least in a statistical sense. So you can pick random numbers and basically apply these prime tests to them until you get success. So you compute n, you compute this number z, which is p minus 1 times q minus 1, and then you pick the second part of your public key, which is e, which is just a number that has no common factors with this number z. All right, so all of this seems magic. It's just sort of rules that from the perspective of the number theory naive just seem to come out of thin air. But you can read about the proofs elsewhere. And then you choose D, such that ED minus 1 is exactly divisible by Z. And again, this is a relatively easy thing to do. And the public key becomes N together with E, and the private key becomes N together with D. Now, what's interesting about, another interesting thing about this process is that this is sort of a symmetric thing. So you can choose to make either NE be the public key or ND be the public key. It doesn't matter, right? Things will work symmetrically. So just not both of them, please. One or the other. So then, to encrypt a message, you raise it to the power E mod N. Okay. And to decrypt the message, you take that thing, M3 E mod N, raise it to the power D, and amazingly enough, what happens is that you get M back. Why is that? Well, it's because of the way that it's because of a theorem that says that, it's kind of hard to see here, that x to the y mod n is equal to x to the y mod z mod n when n is the product of two primes and z is q minus 1 times q minus 1, which is what we picked them to be. So c to the d mod n, which is the original message, that's the encrypted message. There's the application of the decryption exponent. It's MED mod n. But ED mod Z is 1, because we chose it that way, and so you get N. Magic. Okay, we'll look through the example next time, but I wanted to get through the theory.
Professor, I noticed that you said that you could try to submit our own ideas for the final project instead of talking. Would something like Battleship between two players be complicated enough? And if it isn't, I would ask if I could do Battleship where I do some kind of encryption on the messages that are sent to me. And if that won't work,
Grant, tell me
that.
Oh, yeah. So I talked to Murray and he was curious.
You walk out of class, realize you're missing.